This is Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Our guest today is composer Robert Ward, whose best-known work is the 1961 opera The Crucible, which made its debut at the New York City Opera Company in October of 1961. It's based on the play by Arthur Miller. The Crucible received the 1962 Pulitzer Prize for Music and the New York Music Critics Citation as one of America's best and most often performed operas. Ward is a native of Cleveland, Ohio. He's a graduate of the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. He studied with composers Howard Hanson, Albert Stussel, and Aaron Copland. He's a composer of seven operas, numerous symphonic and chamber works. He's received three Guggenheim Fellowships during his career, as well as grants from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He served on the faculties of Columbia and Juilliard, was named president of the North Carolina School of the Arts, and is currently the retired Mary Duke Biddle Professor of Music at Duke University. Ward is in Tulsa for the local premiere of his opera, The Crucible, and a new production by Tulsa Opera, which gets underway tomorrow evening at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. Well, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today. It's very much an honor.
Thank you, Rich.
Take us back to 1961 and the preparations of The Crucible. How did The Crucible come about? This was your second opera and your second collaboration with Bernard Stambler.
Yes.
How did the piece come about?
Well, in a rather unusual way. Actually, our first opera was called He Who Gets Slapped, and it was in production at the New York City Opera. And one day at rehearsal, Bernie and I were sitting there, and one of the members of the cast, who wasn't on stage at the moment, joined us, and in a lull, he said, "What are you planning to do for your next opera?" And we told him that we had several things that we were thinking about, a couple things we liked but we couldn't get rights to, and he said, "Look, I would like to... I suggest that you go and see a wonderful production of a play that I think will make a wonderful American opera," and mentioned The Crucible, which was in its second New York performance or production at that time, off-Broadway at a theater in the Round. And so a couple nights later, actually, my wife and I and my publisher and his wife went to see it. And I was absolutely taken with this. I had not seen the original production. I didn't know the play. And so I went, and I was just wrung out when I came out. And so that was the point at which I decided, well, one way or another, I'm going to get to do this opera. So from there on, it was a fairly long, and there are many amusing episodes in that. Some which came out of that same night, I noticed down three rows ahead of me a woman who had a New Yorker magazine. Now, I knew that the review of He Who Gets Slapped would appear in that issue of the New Yorker, and I was naturally kind of dying to see what was said. But I thought, oh, that's too corny. I can't go down. And that was at the intermission that I had seen that. Well, then when the show ended and I felt so strongly about it, my first thought was, how do I get to Arthur Miller? I wanted to avoid going through the agents and so forth. So I have an older brother of mine who was very much in the theater and radio and television in New York. And so I thought, well, I'll call him. But the next morning, when I got to my office, I picked up a New Yorker on the way, and the review was kind of one of those that a composer dreams about, because the first half of it was about the first performance of Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, which the Bolshoi was doing in New York at that time, mm-hmm. and it was a glowing review of that. But then the second paragraph started with but of perhaps far greater significance, and launched into this sort of hail, a new opera composer has come on the horizon, and this very beautiful review of He Who Gets Slapped. So when I got my brother, it turned out that he was a very close friend of Arthur Miller's producer, knew him. So, and I mentioned this review to him, and that night he called me back and he said, look, for the next performance of He Who Gets Slapped at City Opera, have tickets for the Millers and Frank Taylor, who was his producer. And that night, they probably sold 500 additional tickets at New York City Opera because word kind of got around. And all these people were wanting to see Marilyn Monroe. Well, as it turned out, she never appeared. But Arthur Miller did come, and his agent. And we went out afterward, and that was the start of the whole thing. Yeah. And he was very impressed with He Who Gets Slapped. He never had any strong feeling about musicals, but he did like opera, and so he wanted to make sure that this was sort of a real opera composer, and apparently that impressed him that way.
Did you consult with Arthur Miller? I mean, you had the living playwright there during the process.
Yes. What happened was that once we had made contracts to go ahead and do the work, part of that was that he wanted to be able to meet with us during the, particularly as it turned out, the initial stages. He was at that time working on the movie The Misfits, and so he was in and out of New York a good deal. But when he was we got together, and he was invaluable in the kind of comments that he had to make on the libretto, because turning a play into a libretto involves tremendous compression of the text. And he was wonderful. He understood the kind of cuts we had to make and the changes we made, but then was very positive and very responsive to ideas which we came up with, some of which he liked very much. And one particularly at one point he said, gee, that's better than the original play. And he was very generous that way. His main consideration was that the basic characters be kept intact in their quality and that the basic plot line remained. Well, we felt as strongly about that as he did because they were wonderful characters and it's a very strong story. So after we had about five of those meetings, he was in and out and he said, look, he said, I'm confident with what's going on here. And he said, I just now want to come to the opening performance. And that's the way it worked out, as a matter of fact. But there was one amusing moment when he said something came up about an aria. And he said, well, I suppose, if it turns out that this doesn't work and you don't like it, why, in the rehearsal period, you'll be able to rewrite it. I said, Arthur, we don't have that kind of luxury in the opera world. I said, we've got to go with what we do the first round, so it's very important that we try to do it as well as possible. And so that's the way it worked.
Yeah. Our guest today is a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer, Robert Ward, the composer of The Crucible, which opens tomorrow night in the first of three performances by Tulsa Opera. Let me ask, I'm using Broadway parlance, so excuse me.
All right.
When you were going into the rehearsals and as the material began to shape itself, were you aware you had a hit on your hands? Did you feel going in that this was going to be the successful American opera that it has become?
Well, in the first place, I finished the opera, the full score of the opera, 11 days before the curtain went up.
Whew.
So that I was not even able to go to hardly any initial rehearsals on it. The music director was Emerson Buckley, with whom I'd worked, and I had absolute faith in him. and a very fine stage director who I felt good about, so that I had no way until that time of just breaking myself from out of my studio to get there. But when I did go, the first day I was free and the score was off to copyists and so forth, I walked into the office, and all of the people around the office jumped up and came over and said, "Oh, we're hearing such reports. We have a hit on our hands." And I said, "Don't say it," because you can feel very good about things, and then suddenly the public can be fickle, or it cannot go well, and so forth. But it happened. This did. The dress rehearsal was a mess, but that was all right. But they pulled it together, and the first performance was very thrilling. And great audience reaction. So that you always hope for that, but you don't know whether you're going to get it or not. But in this case, we did.
You mentioned the fact that in the rehearsal process that you were very concerned about keeping the characters intact and right. The story intact.
That's right.
What were some of the other elements that you wanted to make of this piece? I know in listening to the score, you know, you hear the what you would kind of expect in certain places, you know, the mm-hmm. hymn tradition.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And how much research did you do in trying to create that sort of atmosphere of Salem, of 1700s?
Well, I tell you, the religious aspect and the hymn singing, my musical background was as a boy soprano in a Presbyterian church. And as a boy, I sang in everything in school and in church. So that music and the vocal background was not unfamiliar to me. It was very natural, as a matter of fact. And so for the most part, I didn't have to do any great research. I did research on, read a few very fine books about the period and to get some sort of background for the society. But the only character which I sort of had to think about quite a while before I arrived at what I felt was the right music was the character of Tituba. Now, Tituba was a Barbados slave who had been bought and brought north by Reverend Paris. And she was a warm, jolly kind of person, very uncomfortable in this cold Massachusetts climate.
Golden way.
And the only people that she kind of felt any empathy with was the children, and apparently they loved her. She was a warm kind of mammy, and so she would have these games. One of the things, of course, she knew was voodoo, and she knew that music, and I looked into that. It's mainly a kind of chant with rhythm, mm-hmm. percussion instruments. And I felt that would be kind of an anachronism in the show to have just that. Then I thought about the Negro spiritual, and that had some element that was right. But then the other thing I thought about was blues. And I'd had by that time a lot of experience through my war years with swing bands and blues and so forth. So the music ultimately is a sort of combination of those three things. The rhythmic element is there, but the tune in the fourth act, which Tituba sings, is a kind of spiritual, but the accompaniment is actually is very bluesy. So to me, that satisfied me that I had the right quality there.
Well, let's hear an example of that. Here is Tituba's aria from Act 4, "The Devil Say He's Coming."
Oh,
Our guest today is Robert Ward, a composer of The Crucible, a wonderful composer of opera, symphonic music, probably virtually every form, I think, you've attempted over your career. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. One of the things I'm kind of struck about is, you know, you went back to this musical effects to create setting.
Yes.
And I find that somewhat unusual in the operatic world, because usually you have a composer that doesn't think so much about setting. You know, they compose their music mm-hmm. to go in any setting.
Yes.
Why do you spend much time? I know that on other operas that are set, say, in the jazz age, you put yes. a little jazz in there.
That's right.
You had an opera that looked at medieval French idioms.
That's right.
Abelard and Heloise.
That's right.
What is your approach there?
Well, to me, you know, the thing which the first notes of an opera must do is to set some basic tone of what is coming afterward, so to arouse an expectation there. In the case of The Crucible, this is a social drama in a sense. It's the hysteria of a whole village. So the first thing that one hears in the orchestra is sort of a screaming music of, and it's hysterical kind of music, and when it comes back in the context of the opera, it's first time when little Betty cries out and she goes crazy up in the room upstairs, and it's associated with those moments. So that began that way. In the case of Abelard and Heloise, the French Renaissance opera, this was 11th century, and the music of that time was chant. And so it actually begins with one's hearing the voices of an ancient Gregorian chant sung by the nuns in this building. And And for instance, in the most recent opera I've written, Roman Fever, two of the characters are two 1920s flappers. Well, to me, the thing which sort of sets those people up immediately is the jazz of that period, which had a very distinctive flavor. And so their first kind of duet is set in that musical idiom. Now, it uses the kind of materials that I would use in any other piece, but clearly the rhythms immediately associated, I think, with anyone who knows the music of that period or has heard it with the period. And so this is a kind of eclecticism, but I find it very telling on the stage.
Yeah. Let me switch gears from the Crucible to just about your musical career. You're a student of Howard Hanson. Hear a little bit of Hanson, and I would dare say, without risk of offending, but you know, very conservative for a 20th century American composer. During the time when you were starting out, 40s, 50s, I mean, there was everything going on.
That's right.
Was that label, if it was placed on you, was that a detriment at times?
Well, it's always curious. When I was a student at Eastman, I have reviews which talked about this radical young man. Now, it's sort of the eyes of the beholder here, because at that time, no critics had much experience of contemporary music. The Rites of Spring was still considered a tremendously radical work. And even some of the late works of Ravel and Debussy and Hindemith was first being heard at that time. By the time I wrote The Crucible, I had sort of made a lot of fundamental decisions about the kind of music I wanted to write. Though I appreciated all of the innovations of the 20th century, I did not want to throw out the language of earlier music and folk music and so forth. And so the combination of teachers I had, Hansen, who wrote a very lush kind of, but very 20th century kind of music, but it was melodic and singable. Copeland, who used folk tunes in a very distinguished way. And then several other teachers who had influence in the same direction. They didn't want to go completely to any of the new fads of the century. Although one heard these, one took some things from them. So I kind of established a language which I felt could be used for very simple scenes where it could be children, it could be folk-like, to things that included very intensely hysterical music, which you could never find before this century. And all those things are there. And to me, this makes a very broad palette from which one can work when you're working with a theater.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever a time when you felt like, you know, when atonal music, when 12-tone music was ascendant, you felt like, you know, the fact that, well, should I maybe investigate this more, or you know, just because it was, you know, tonal music was kind of out of fashion.
That's right. I investigated it very thoroughly indeed. Few people are aware of this. But in fact, I've written quite a lot of 12-tone music. However, it's tonal.
Yes.
I refuse to go along with some of the arbitrary kind of things that were involved in the minds of many 12-tone composers. And I was very interested in another aspect, which was opened up, I think, by 12-tone music, which was the rhythmic side of thematic material. And that's quite a long discussion. I won't get into it. But in any case, that was very interesting to me. And so that I've utilized that in a number of works. And but the music comes out not sounding different than my other music because I have a certain harmonic palette, which I like and which seems personal. And so that'll appear whether I'm using 12-tone techniques or whether I'm writing a sonata of some kind.
As an American opera composer, you know, you look at the season of the Met, you may see one American opera, maybe not.
Yeah.
And this is arguably our greatest opera house.
Right.
Let me ask you, as an American opera composer, how do you feel about, you know, the American opera companies that kind of fail to embrace our own?
That's right. Well, for 20 or almost 30 years, there was not a single American opera done at either the Chicago Lyric or the Metropolitan. It was a complete blackout on those works. It was the New York City Opera and the San Francisco Opera, both of which did new works. And to me, this is a kind of national disgrace, which they are rectifying a little bit. The Met has done a couple things. And the Chicago is now, they're really doing something every year. They've turned down quite a turnaround, which is not surprising because in earlier times, Chicago was a kind of hotbed of new things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad to have this happening. The situation is better in some respects now in that a lot of new works are being performed. And however, the other aspect of today is that new works are being performed, and regardless of the reaction, they can have a wonderful reaction in wherever they're performed, Houston or, Seattle or wherever it may be, anywhere in the country. But this has practically no spin-off in terms of successive performances. They're not picked up, partially because we don't have strong agents out there working with those companies, and partially because the glamour goes with the premiere. And once
right.
that glamour's mm-hmm. off, they're looking for something else. So that is slow because there have been some very fine operas written, which have been very successful, but we need to have those picked up by. And there is an effort on the part of Opera America and the National Endowment. They're aware of this. So if they still have money to put where their beliefs are, maybe they'll help that situation.
Well, it seems like the trend is getting better, but it is true. The second performance, so to speak,
right.
or nowadays a new opera may go several places on that
That's
first
right.
run.
That's right.
But getting it picked up again, it seems like they invariably go to the shelf.
Where it goes to those second places, usually that's been arranged before it, right at the beginning, so that, but it's after that that, but opera has never been a form that, particularly, I would say, the last 150 years, that it was immediately picked up by the public, because it was about that time that you began to have a popular musical theater as compared to the high class. Paris was, of course, the great example with a Paris opera, which wouldn't do anything but a very sort of high-class opera, as they what they thought was. Carmen couldn't get produced there. It had to go to the Comique.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where all of the premieres of the great French operas took place, at the Comique, not at the Paris Opera. And we have that situation here. The Met is a museum,
mm-hmm.
and which is fine, but I could wish that some of the power that they could exert on the scene was being exerted toward the music of our own time and of our own people.
You brought up an interesting point. What do you think of this trend of opera companies performing musical comedies from our own century? Do you think that's
you
that's
know,
a good trend?
Yeah, I think it's fine. We have made these totally fallacious compartments into which this is an opera, this is a musical comedy, and this is an operetta. Well, if you actually look at the repertory, none of those compartments hold up. Carmen was an operetta when it started. We do Fledermaus in the opera houses and call it an opera. It never was an opera. It was an operetta. And I wish we would just stop putting those labels on them and just say, this is Tosca, you know, this is The Crucible or whatever, just call it by the name of what it is and let people go and enjoy it, because if it's good theater, they'll enjoy it, and if it isn't, they won't.
Robert Ward, the composer of the Pulitzer Prize-winning opera The Crucible, speaking with us on Studio Tulsa. We'll continue our conversation with Mr. Ward in the second half of the program. Tulsa Opera presents The Crucible beginning tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall, with additional performances March 2nd and March 4th. Studio Tulsa is produced by Casey Morgan. Our studio engineer is Daniel Bryan. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. In the second half, more with Robert Ward on Studio Tulsa.
Queen, under the laws of the province of Massachusetts, this court is now in session.
This is Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Our guest today is the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Robert Ward, the composer of The Crucible, which opens tomorrow night in the first of three performances by Tulsa Opera. You've used with your collaborator Bernard Stempler texts of Arthur Miller, Edith
yes.
Wharton.
No, he was not involved in the Roman fever. He was involved in He Who Gets Slapped,
right.
Our first opera, and The Crucible. Then our next opera, which was originally called Lady from Colorado and is now Lady Kate, is an operetta, in fact. And the third one, which was Claudia Laguerre, and that is Ibsen. Hedda Gabler, transplanted to Charleston, South Carolina after the Civil War.
Huh. But you have used this literary material.
Yes.
I'm interested in, today we're seeing pop cultural figures,
yes.
Nixon in China,
yes.
the Marilyn Monroe, death of Klinghoffer,
yes.
you know, today's headlines becomes
yeah.
tomorrow's opera. What do you think of that trend?
Well, I think this is fine. And what it finally comes down to is whether the opera is a good opera. All of those people are potentially very viable stage characters, and the question simply becomes, is the story as it's told in the context of an opera, is it done well? And if it is, fine.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had thoughts of doing a situation like a current event
as
an opera?
The sixth opera I did was an opera called Minutes Till Midnight with and the writer on that opera was Daniel Lang, who for many years wrote all of the articles in The New Yorker about the nuclear testing, the testing of atomic and nuclear bombs, and that was sort of his special compartment. Indeed, he was present at the test out in the West, which got out of control, and he died of leukemia probably, and this probably came from having been in that fallout at that thing, and died before the opera was produced, as a matter of fact. Now, the subject of that was fictitious, but it was a contemporary nuclear physicist doing a big project on solar energy in a university. It involved the Cold War and so forth. So though this wasn't a specific contemporary character, it was very contemporary in that sense.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about Minutes to Midnight.
Yes.
It has a social message.
Very definitely.
Obviously, The Crucible does as well. Is that
yes.
important to you in your work?
Very definitely. Uh-huh. One way or another, there is a sort of broad theme in all of the operas that in He Who Gets Slapped, it was The main character, he is a visionary character who finds that he's too far ahead of his times. No one accepts this. And his coming to a kind of philosophy of, well, you do what you can, but that's all you can do. And in Crucible, it's very obviously, it's the integrity of the individual against societal hysteria. Lady from Colorado and Lady Kate, which is a comedy, but there are several scenes in which there's strong patriotic feeling. Another scene in which there's a sort of basic, simple philosophy of about humanity and so forth. In the case of Claudia Laguerre, it's really a study of suicide. And so each of the operas has, and again in Abelard and Heloise, this is a study of in a way, of the integrity of a rebel and in society. And so in a way, Roman Fever is the only one which does not deal with that kind of issue. It's just an incredible story. And but what it does is, I think, is a deeper study of very feminine things. So I suppose in one way it's kind of feminist.
Yeah. For those not familiar with the Wharton story, tell us a little about Roman Fever. This is your latest work. It premiered about a year and a half ago.
Right. Well, the story of Roman Fever is the story of two very recently widowed mothers who had first known themselves, each other, in Rome 20 years before. And they have, after their husbands died, each decided independently that they would return to Rome on a kind of sentimental journey, taking their daughters with them. Turns out that they arrive at the same hotel where they had stayed 20 years before, with their daughters who had known each other, and they meet and they get very friendly. And what in fact the story is the unfolding of what happened 20 years before. And the original story is only a conversation of the two mothers. You hear about the daughters and so forth. Well, two 20-year-old flappers were just too good to keep off in the wings. So we brought them right into the story. And we also felt that made a quartet of women's voices. And then we felt that in an hour you would want a little relief from women's voices. So there's an Italian waiter who has one rather important moment in the show. And and the thing about this story that people who have read it never forget is the last line. In a last line of six words or so, it just blows your mind because you suddenly discover what went on 20 years ago in this one line, and it leaves you right with that at the end. And it was a great opportunity not only to set just that story, but these days, we have very active opera workshops in conservatories and universities, most of which have an abundance of women and a much smaller number of capable men. And so they're looking constantly for a repertory which is predominantly women. Mm-hmm. And this opera fits right into that category, and indeed immediately has been picked up by many colleges and conservatories. There are three productions coming on, one going on right now, and of this, and I have a feeling it'll get a lot more.
Yeah. So. Well, we wish you the best of luck with that. What are you working on currently? I know that are you exclusively writing for the stage now, or do you continue?
Oh no, I haven't. As a matter of fact, I wrote Roman Fever, but. I wrote about 4 years ago my first large ballet, which, however, took me back to New England. It's on the Scarlet Letter.
Uh-huh.
And I've done a a violin concerto, which seems to be doing very well for a violinist named Sarah Johnson. And I've done two choral pieces, one for the dedication of a new audit fine arts center in a very good private school in Raleigh, North Carolina, and the other for a series of religious conferences at the University of Indiana. And I'm about to embark on a couple new chamber works. So I have never been interested in only one media. I work back and forth.
Uh-huh. Does it keep everything else fresh, going back and forth like that?
Oh, I think so, because, you know, when one writes an opera, one thinks, oh, well, one is just following a story and so forth. But if you analyze closely the great operas, they involve abstract musical forms all over the place, but they are in the context of the story. And so you're dealing with those abstract forms when you do chamber music or a symphony. And so they work back and forth together very well.
Mm. Let me ask you, it's been about a little over 30 years since The Crucible.
It's yes.
Arguably your most successful work.
Yeah.
Is it closest to your heart still?
No, you know, it was never closest to my heart.
Really?
you know, I was very happy that it was successful, and I'm very happy about the work. I feel that, you know, sometimes you write a work and it does all the things you hoped it would, and that work certainly has done that. When I'm working on a new work, that's my favorite child at that point. And I hope it does well once I've put it off. But but the rest is just a matter of what happens as it gets out to audiences and performers. And The Crucible has done very well, and I'm happy about it. But it is certainly not a favorite work. It was a work in which some works that one writes sort of advance one. You go out and you're trying to do different things. And in the case of opera, the story very often demands that you do that, so you go out and do it creatively. But there are other works that one might write. For instance, my thing, I did an early song cycle, which I sort of arrived at some new plateaus in that, and the first sonata for violin and piano I wrote was one of those pieces, and so from that standpoint they're rather special. But
yeah, you touched on something I want to ask about, and that is, you know, when you're creating a work of art, is it difficult to let go and let others say what they may? And
no,
without...
I read criticisms to and there are some critics who have been actually very helpful. They're thoughtful, they're analytical, and they're experienced. In other cases, some of the best criticism I've ever had, I always remember one which was done by a New Yorker writer called Philip Hamburger, who you may have read. Mm-hmm. Now, Philip Hamburger always, when they said they'd like him to review a concert, said, look, I'm not a musician. I shouldn't be doing that. And they insisted that he did. And he wrote some of the most remarkable reviews I've ever read because he was completely a sensitive layman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wasn't bringing any kind of predilections to it. He just recognized and could describe how he felt. And secondarily, he could watch what was going on and sense how the rest of the audience was reacting and could express it with wonderful words. So that critic kind of critic is very valuable. And the worst kind is the people who don't really know very much, the sort of baseball writer who gets assigned to music criticism, but decides they know all the answers, you know, and that's disastrous.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure getting to know you, and we're so happy that this work is seeing performances here in Tulsa, and we wish you the best of luck. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you ever so much, Rich.
Robert Ward, composer of the Pulitzer Prize-winning opera The Crucible, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Tulsa Opera presents The Crucible beginning tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. Additional performances scheduled for March 2nd and March 4th. The number for tickets, you contact Tulsa Opera's box office at 587-4811. It sounds like an outstanding production. We're going to leave you today here on Studio Tulsa with more music from The Crucible. Here's Judge Danforth singing his aria from Act 4. Music from The Crucible by Robert Ward. Tulsa Opera presents The Crucible beginning Saturday night. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.